All right, gentlemen, this week I'm going to be talking about building godly homes. I have in my office the two side walls are lined with bookshelves, and I have two entire shelves that are laden with books about marriage and the home. I will probably be using almost none of the material I've gotten from those books this week. It is not to say there's no good material there. It is to say that I think that so much of what is written about marriage and the home is dealing with the most surface symptoms of what is wrong and what is dysfunctional and what is breaking down in homes and families today. They're dealing with the emotional fallout that comes from generations of neglect about what God says about the home. And they think if we can get each other to sort of emotionally reconnect, then maybe we could fix everything. And let me just tell you, it won't. We will continue to have emotional turmoil in the homes as much as we stay distant from what God says about the homes. So I want to talk about homes this week in maybe some ways that we don't normally. This will not be a marriage seminar. This is not going to be tips for how to get along with your wife, how to emotionally connect with your children. I want to talk at a much more fundamental and deeper level about the bedrock about on which homes ought to be built. To that end, let me start with this question. What are homes for? Security? Okay.
Make a spiritual heritage to God. To shape the church and society.
Okay, to shape the church and society. Josh, what did you say?
Reflect to the world our relationship to God.
These are some good answers.
To raise a family.
Why would we want to raise a family?
God desires godly offspring.
Okay, good.
Be fruitful and multiply,
right? I don't think any of these answers are wrong. And in fact, some of them are touching on the things that we'll talk about this week. I think it's a question we're not asking. Certainly societally. I think from the standpoint of society, what's happened is if we've reduced the home, just like everything else, to a question of efficiency and personal gain. And what people are finding is that really the home in the modern context, the modern thought process, just doesn't feel very efficient. It doesn't feel like it's adding much economic value. Now, incidentally, people are wrong even about that. But they don't think it does, and so they're stepping away from the notions of how valuable the home is. I think societies are starting to scratch at the surface of understanding how valuable they are. In Japan, it's one of the countries in the world that has been an economic powerhouse. Right. If you are a child of the 90s like me, you understand, you know, manufacturing carried with it this just sort of understanding of quality and good value. And yet they're struggling to stay afloat economically. And one of the primary reasons is they've given up on the home. They are not reproducing at replacement rates. And incidentally, neither are we, but they're worse off than we are. And people think, what does that matter? You know, I mean, not having children, that's not a big deal. In fact, we've been told for years that people are having too many children and we've got a population problem, right? Isn't it kind of good? No. It is never good when we are not having more children than what we have had in the past. When populations are shrinking, that is a moral problem. And I want to try to convey that as we go along.
But we're getting a little bit ahead of ourselves. Let me back up. What we're going to talk about this morning is the nature of what we're going to try to accomplish this week. There are two things that I want us to do. I want us to, number one, try to recover some vocabulary. I think there's a lot of work that has to be done for us living in the 21st century, reading a book that was written in the first century, to go and figure out what they meant by words that have had 2,000 years to sort of adjust their meaning over the years. A couple of years ago, we did this with the words grace and faith. And one of the points that I really wanted to make is that when Paul wrote the word charis, or grace, or when Paul wrote the word pistis, or faith, that he meant something that is at least somewhat and maybe even drastically different than what people mean when they use those words today. And for a number of different reasons. There's just so many reasons that those vocabulary words get changed, not the least of which is the Reformation movement. And so we think Paul is sort of having the argument that Reformationists were having in the 1500s, and he didn't have that in mind at all. And so we've got to go try to get back to that first century. The classic example of this is baptism, right? When we read the word baptism in our Bibles, we understand that a lot of baggage has been added to that. And again, that baggage is partly because the translators punted on translating that word into the English language. They were like, that's not going to go over so well if we write down immersion. Let's just write those Greek letters down in English and let people do with it what they want to do. And so that means the burden comes to us to walk people back to the first century, not to the Reformation or even to the Catholic Church, but get all the way back to the first century and say, listen, people use the word baptism not just in a religious sense. It was a word that meant to immerse something. And so it's just a normal word. Grace and faith are the same way. Well, that's what I want to do when it comes to the home, is try to do some of that recovery work. I think there are a lot of words that get used about the home, about the household, that have lost some significance, and maybe in some cases have lost a lot of significance in our current vernacular, because our culture is so very different. We've shifted in massive ways, and we'll talk about some of those shifts in other lessons. I want to give you an example of this. In Colossians chapter 1 and verse 15, Colossians chapter 1 and verse 15, of Christ it says, who is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. All right. If you have children and you have a firstborn child and you introduce your child as your firstborn, in today's vernacular, what all do you mean by that? He's born first. That's literally all you mean by that. What did they mean in the first century when they called someone the firstborn? What all went along with that? The heir, preeminence, rank, double portion. They were the inheritor of the title of everything. The greatest privileges of the household were bestowed upon the firstborn. That doesn't mean nobody else gets any privileges, but the greatest privileges. Now, the Bible doesn't just swim in the culture, or it doesn't just make usage of the culture of the firstborn. We see the history is saturated with that concept. Going back to the Old Testament, you see aspects of that. God subverts some of those privileges in his story. And so we have, you know, Ishmael, who is technically the firstborn. But then, of course, Isaac is the child of promise. And so Ishmael's rights such as they were subverted in favor of Isaac. And then even more so with Jacob and Esau, you have Esau's firstborn rights subverted. And then that carries over into the story of Jacob's children. And you have Joseph, who is the favored son. And he subverts the rights of the firstborn by making Joseph's sons into full sons themselves. And so in a sort of roundabout way is able to give Joseph a double portion. He's able to make him a firstborn by default, sort of, by giving both of his sons a portion. And so the Bible, even as it's subverting while recognizing, while pointing out, this is not the norm, right? Firstborn ought to get these things, and then here are ways that those things are being subverted. So when we come to Colossians chapter 1 and verse 15, we need all of that in order to understand what's being said here. And in fact, the one way that we define firstborn, which is to say he's born first, is not the way Colossians 1 and verse 15 is using it. It's not saying Christ is the one who was born first in creation. Rather, it's saying he's the one who has all the privileges of firstborn. He is the one who has preeminence. He is the one who has all that glory that goes along with being the firstborn. So do you see how a loss of vocabulary, it doesn't just make it hard for us to understand how to order our families, but it makes it hard for us to understand the family language that God uses to define and describe his own household. And so we're put at a distance. And we need to recover some of that. Now, let me go one step further with regards to that. When you think about the privileges of the firstborn in a modern context, let's say that we were to try to reinstate some of that privilege and status and so forth. What would you think about that? Marsha, you think that would be pretty good? Probably. Yeah, yeah. What do you think people would think about that? It's not fair. Pardon? With respect to inheritance, right? Double portion. What? There'd be lawsuits. But it wouldn't just be that. I think people in the church would say, hey, we're supposed to be impartial. We're not supposed to favor any of our children. We're supposed to... Let me just say, I think that this is a reality that God does not condemn. It's a reality that he just recognizes. And he says here... There's an appropriateness of hierarchy. Boy, I think we've lost all sense of that. Like, once we introduce notions of different places of honor in a household, it's like, wait. We are so saturated with egalitarian ideas that we look backwards, we look back to when there were distinctions in a household based on, you know, things that were even outside of your control. That's one of the things in our minds. Like, you shouldn't get privileges that you didn't earn. You think that's got any ramifications about the way we think about things? You shouldn't get privileges you didn't earn. Well, I tell you what, God doesn't talk like that. He talks about positions of honor that you are born into, and in fact, positions of dishonor that you are born into, and about how you ought to handle that. So, I think not only do we need to do the vocabulary recovery, but we need to do the recovery of figuring out why those things were valuable in the first place. If you look back at the way people talked about firstborn or any other concept back there in the first century, and you go, well, yeah, the Bible uses that to make these illustrations, but boy, aren't we glad we've gotten past all of that. Then you are guilty of what C.S. Lewis calls chronological snobbery. In his book, Surprised by Joy, which is sort of an autobiographical work, that's what he accuses himself of. He says, I came to realize that I had fallen into that pattern, that notion that in our day, we have come to figure out the most things. And that everything that we've set aside in history, we have set aside because we have become smarter than those things. You've heard of the dustbin of history. You know, we've put all those things into the dustbin of history. I want to suggest to you at this moment that we have stopped calling in official government documents mothers, and now we call them birthing persons. that some people are finally waking up and saying, let's go dig through that dumpster and see if there's some things we might need to get back out. Maybe they weren't ready to be thrown away. And so when we look at concepts that feel antiquated, don't puff up and say, well, that's the way they were back then. It is the way they were back then. I want to suggest this. Truth is always back there. In our minds, we are cultivated to think truth is just around the corner in the future. We're always discovering new things. We're always learning new things. And whatever we haven't learned, we will learn eventually. Truth is always, the most fundamental truths, the only important truths, are always backwards. They are 2,000 years ago revealed. And when we think that we have somehow learned better than those truths, I guarantee you the opposite is true. We have learned worse. Do you believe that there is such a thing as primitive man? G.K. Chesterton in his book, Everlasting Man, talks about this concept of primitive man. And we go look at the cave drawings and we say, oh, this is the way people used to do art. And he mocks that idea relentlessly, and it's just a joyous read. One of the things he says is, maybe some guys just got stuck in a cave and all they had was a stick to draw with. You ever been somewhere and all you had to do was draw with a stick? Maybe this wasn't their version of Rembrandt. But even still, if this was whatever culture's version of Rembrandt, can I suggest to you that when we see man in what we call a primitive state, that we are not looking at the history of man, but or our history. You know, that's what we think sometimes. We say we're tracing man back, and we get so far back, and he's like living like this, and we get so far back, and he's living like this. And we talk about the hunter-gatherer, right? Tom, I just remembered to turn this on, but Ken's got you covered. The hunter-gatherer, right? You read psychology books, and we're still being, we do that because we used to be hunter-gatherers. And then it's only in very recent periods that the farmer has come along. Well, I don't know, but Genesis chapter 4 says farming's been there for quite some time. So I'm not so sure about that. And that societies continue to elevate and so forth, and that they've moved from these tribal ways of living and these nomadic ways of living, and it kept increasing. I don't know, Genesis chapter 11 seems to indicate people have been wanting to build cities for a long, long time. I think when we look at the tribal societies, what we are seeing is the result of the devolution of man that always devolves when they exalt paganism over God. So when you see that tribal village lifestyle and you go, that's our history. No, brethren, that is more likely our future if this country does not, and in the Western world in general, does not repent and begin to put truth back in its place. You think, oh, we could never end up there. I mean, you think people will give all this up? You know, it's the blessings of modern society, not willingly, not on purpose, but they'll throw out all the things that got us here, and guess what? Everything that was built on that and came from that will go away too. So, as we look back at antiquated families and antiquated homes and the ideas that God communicates the home with, we want to say not just that's how it used to be and that's fine that it used to be that way, but say what was good about that and what was damaging about getting rid of that. And I don't mean that every piece of old homes is something that needs to be recovered, but I think there's a lot that needs to be recovered. All right. Well, the second thing that I want to talk about is the scope of the home. That is, what all does the home represent? How is it connected to God's home, to heavenly realities, to eternal realities? Josh hinted at that with his comment about our representing what's going on in God's house. We need to take a little bit of a detour here to develop this point. In 1 Corinthians chapter 10, I think it was 3, maybe 4 years ago, we talked about the glory of the law, and maybe we went here. I usually like to, so I assume we did. He says in 1 Corinthians 10, I do not want you to be unaware, brothers, that our fathers were all under the cloud and all passed through the sea, and all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and the sea, and all ate the same spiritual food, and all drank the same spiritual drink, for they were drinking from a spiritual rock which followed them, and the rock was Christ. Well, I love, as far as when people are like, you know, what sort of Old Testament, New Testament connections, I love this passage. It's just full of them. Now, I don't think that what Paul means is that Israel understood the connection between passing through the sea and baptism into Christ. I'm not even sure they were aware that there was a Christ, at least not in any substantive sense. Not much had been said about him yet. Really, just the very beginning seeds had been planted at that point of who Christ was. So I don't know that they got that. I am certain that they did not get the points of the manna. That's one of the problems that Moses himself reveals. And then, of course, Jesus brings that back up in his really blistering critique of Israel after the feeding of the 5,000 in John's account. When they come back for bread, and he's like, you've never gotten it, right? You didn't get it back then when it was revealed to you, and bread was given to you by God, and you certainly don't get it now. And his point is, I'm the bread. God's your bread. You don't get it. So they don't get that bread, that manna, represented the spiritual food in Christ. And they certainly did not get when they were drinking from the rock, that spiritual rock, which followed them was Christ. So, I'm going to go back to those stories in just a moment, and I don't want you to think that what I mean is that they should have seen all the significance of that. I just want you to see that it was there whether they knew it or not. And that's what I'm going to say about the home. There is significance in the home, and you think, well, people don't see that. I don't care if they see it. It's there whether they know it or not. All right, go back to Numbers chapter 20 then. Numbers chapter 20 is the second occasion on which the people drank from the rock. Now what I want to do is I want to take what Paul's done for me, which he's connected the dots, right? He said, when they drank from the rock was Christ. Now, I want to go back and say, how does that work? How does the rock represent Christ? Well, there's two occasions, as I just mentioned. In the first occasion, God commanded Moses to strike the rock. And this is upon their exodus from Egypt. This is Exodus chapter 17. And so he strikes the rock. And the waters come forth, and you can pretty clearly see how that would represent Christ. Because when Christ was struck, and that's the same word, that word struck is used in Isaiah 53, that, you know, that Christ, the servant is struck for our transgressions. So the rock is struck, and what happens? Upon striking the rock, The water of life flows forth. And of course, upon striking Christ, the water of life flows forth. Well, that brings us to Numbers chapter 20. And God commands Moses in this case at the waters of Meribah. He tells him to go in verse 8 and speak to the rock before their eyes that it may yield its water. How does that represent Christ? Well, I think that when we come to Christ for the waters of life, we come to Him by the crucifixion, by the striking of the rock. That is what it is. And so we must come by root of that crucifixion. How do we do that? Well, of course, that's baptism. We see that connection. We're buried with Christ, right? We're crucified with Christ. And so now we have access to the waters of life. How do you continue to have access to the waters of life? Well, let's say, for instance, particularly, you've sinned and you need access to the waters of life. You don't go striking the rock again, right? Christ doesn't have to be crucified over and over. Now that the rock has been struck, you've been baptized, you can speak to the rock and the waters flow forth. I think that's a beautiful picture, right? But Moses strikes the rock again. And in his striking the rock again, he messes up the picture a little bit, doesn't he? He subverts the teaching, the eternal realities, the heavenly realities that God is teaching not just them and even not particularly them, but is ultimately teaching us, right? God has in mind when he tells Moses to speak to the rock instead of striking the rock, it's not just he's like, you know, I think I'll change things up today. How about I speak to... No, God is thinking, I am interested in teaching people something who will read this thousands of years later. And so, I want you to do it this way. And Moses only sees what's going on in his narrow little world. And what's going on in his little world is that these people are insufferable. And they are. And because of his anger at their grumbling and their petulance, he does not heed God's instruction. And what he does in not heeding God's instruction is not just disobey a command of God, which is bad enough, but he gets in the way of God teaching eternal truths for all time. Do you see why this is such a big deal? Do you see why God would say, you will not enter into the land of promise? You know, it is odd sometimes when people read that and they go, I mean, there's some people who messed up a lot worse than this, seemingly, and don't get the severity of the punishment. I think that's part of the problem. We don't see how big a deal it is. We don't see the eternal implications of departing from God's pattern in this place. It's a bigger deal. There's more going on. I believe when we make departures from God's pattern for the home, we are teaching false doctrine. We are subverting God's instruction about who He is, who His Son is, who His church is. All of these things are wrapped up in the home. And we are supposed to be preaching glorious sermons to the world around us. And instead, we are getting wrapped up in our own pettiness and our own narrow concerns and taking our eyes off of what we're supposed to be reflecting. And let me just tell you, we have less excuse to do it than Moses because we've been given the full picture. Moses could at least be excused from the standpoint of he didn't know what all he was getting into. Our problem is we don't know because we haven't even looked. We're not even paying attention. Now, let me give you another example where it is the home that is under consideration. God, in Genesis chapter 12, gave Abraham the promise that from his seed he would make a nation. And as the stars of the heaven or as the dust on the earth, or the sand, that so would be his descendants. And you know about the tension that is there with that promise because at that point there is no heir. And that tension increases as time goes along. We get to chapter 15 and he's like, man, I got this one guy. And I mean, he's a servant. That's my heir. Is that who you're talking about? That's not who I'm talking about. Chapter 16, there's still no heir. And at that point, the tension reaches critical mass for Abraham and Sarah. And Sarah says, I have an idea. I have a way that we can get access to the blessings of God's promises. And it'll be through my maidservant, Hagar. And you can go into her, you can have her as a wife, you can have an heir, and then all these things can come true. Now, that's a decision that when we look at it, we talk about Sarah's lack of faith, and then of course Abraham's subsequent lack of faith. They didn't trust God's plan, they tried to do it their own way. There's all sorts of lessons you can learn there. But does this have broader and more far-reaching implications than simply Abraham not doing it God's way? What are some of the subsequent implications? Yeah, you have the people of Ishmael. Are they still, do they continue to be a problem for Israel? Yeah, what else? Yeah, Galatians chapter 4 picks up this detour of Abraham. And it says, look at Hagar and Sarah, and look at the children of Hagar and Sarah. Look at Ishmael and Isaac, though he doesn't specifically point to them. He's mostly pointing to their mothers and then the seed that comes from them. And essentially what he says is, I had instruction in mind by the way I brought Isaac about. God, when he promised Abraham an heir and eventually fulfilled that promise through Isaac, was saying more and pointing to greater truths than just the notion or just the immediate concerns of Abraham and his family. He was painting a picture of how he creates a people. Through promise, through fulfilling of his promises. And Abraham and Sarah devised a way to create a people their own way. And by the time we get to the New Testament, the children of Israel, who ought to have thought and perceived themselves as the children who were created by promise, had really become that children of the flesh. And so he uses Abraham's departure to say, you are like this, you're children of the flesh. But what I wanted was the picture I was painting. I wanted the picture of a child of promise, and that's Isaac. And you have become just like Abraham's departure and not like my plan of the children of promise. So we might look at Abraham's issues there with Sarah, and sometimes I'm not against taking practical lessons, but sometimes we get so quickly to the moralization and the practical lesson that we miss the internal implications. So like we're like, see, this is what happens when you listen to your nagging wife. And then she's upset. Have you ever had that where your wife says, you ought to do this, you ought to do this. And then you finally do it, and she goes, why'd you do that? Like this is some lesson about the way men and women interact with each other. Maybe it is. Maybe you can get that. But let me just tell you, a lot more is going on than that. And the implications are much farther reaching than just how men and women get along and how homes should function or not function. I'm fine with those temporal applications. But if we only make the temporal applications and we're not connecting them to the eternal implications, then can I suggest to you that like everything else, when you take God out of the picture, and I think that is what a lot of our books on the home have done. They've just become pop psychology, right? God is there. They mention his name, but they're really not using him and his wisdom to teach about the home. They just sort of bring him alongside what people are saying in pop psychology. But when you remove God, whether you do it, you actually remove his name, or you just remove him in substance, then everything that is connected to him begins to crumble and fade away. And so we want to maintain that connectivity as we're talking about the home, and understand those realities. As I said, our homes are pointing to eternal truths. They are doing it faithfully or they are doing it unfaithfully. When I perform wedding ceremonies, one of the things that I always say is, today you begin preaching a new sermon. Now, it's not new in the way that it's one that you just came up with. It's new in that you are now preaching it. You can either preach it faithfully or unfaithfully. You can say true things about God, who He is, who Christ is, who the church is, or you can blaspheme. Now, I will say, most of the world is blaspheming. They are blaspheming God in so many ways. And maybe we think, yes, gay marriage, yeah. Well, that is an ultimate blasphemy. But they're blaspheming God in everyday marriages. They're blaspheming the roles of Christ and the church and how they interact and who God as the Father is and who children are. And in so many ways, they're rejecting that. And in rejecting that, they are rejecting where their home is founded, what it's based on. I've been talking about this idea lately, about how connected everything is to God and how even Christians, we've allowed the notion to creep into our mind that we can continue to hold on to certain realities while not personally rejecting God. I mean, I still believe in God, but I don't have to bring God into the public sphere, right? I can keep my beliefs about God at home, and then we can have the truths that we all agree on out in public life, right? Do you wonder why somebody says math is oppressive? Have you heard that? Math is white supremacy. Math is, you know, Western oppression and whatever. And people are like, what on earth are you saying? Like, math is math. Not without God, it's not. You took people say, you know, math, it's just truth. If you take away the absolute truth, then all other absolutes go with it. And we are sitting in a society where we thought we could say we don't have to talk about God. We can talk about math without God. You don't have math without God. Or science, or history, or any other thing that you want to talk about. Everything that exists, exists through Him. And so people with a home, they go like, listen, I want you to help me in my marriage. I want you to help me have a better relationship with my wife, with my children. And I open up my Bible and they go, now listen, I'm not religious. I'm not looking for that sort of advice. Then you'll need to look somewhere else. And you'll continue to find the solutions that don't work because you set this aside. And you ignored the one who created marriage and math and science and everything else in the world. You can't fix things without Him. And so, we've got to get back to the beginning. In our best efforts, as we preach on the home, I think we are usually not saying enough. I think we're not going far enough. I think we're saying things, we are more informed by culture than we are by Scripture. So, for instance, we're scared of talking about the glory of marriage because maybe we got some single people who wish they were married. We don't want to make them feel bad. I don't want to make them feel bad. But I will not sacrifice the truth for their feelings. And if I get up and I say, marriage is a glorious institution, and I want to encourage, people say, you know, don't be like those parents who are always pushing their kids to get married. You mean like all of human history? I want to push young people to get married. It is the foundational element of society. It's the first institution that God created. It is good, and it is not good for man to be alone, and I will beat that drum till I die. And if somebody goes, yeah, but I'm single. Okay, be single for the glory of God. But don't rain on everybody else's parade while you're at it. In fact, those single people ought to be beating that drum as well. Paul was single, and he beat that drum. I want to say to people, have children. I think we've made that into a morally neutral decision. I mean, you can have them or not. It's just kind of personal preference. It is not personal preference. God says children are good, and he says they're good for particular reasons, and a lot of those reasons are reasons we've lost. And so as we'll talk later in the week, we've made children virtually into very expensive pets. And what people have decided, they're not having children anymore because I can go get a furry pet who's less expensive and doesn't get sassy. I'll just have my fur babies. You think that's morally neutral? Where we've gotten to on that? It is not. You think people are not having to deciding not to have children because of morally neutral reasons? The reasons I hear, man, there's a lot of stuff we want to do. Children would just get in the way. They are reflections of our self-absorbed society. Amen. That says, my pleasure is what is paramount in life instead of God's pleasure. Because that is the thing we should be looking to. And in fact, like C.S. Lewis says, they are losing both. Because you think those people are happy? The happiness quotients, insofar as they're kept up with, are not good. We're more prosperous. You know, that's one thing people say, I can't afford children. We are the most prosperous society in history, and we're having less children than ever. The problem is not we can't afford them. So, I want us to think in those kinds of terms. And what I want us to do is to point people's eyes upward when we're talking about these things. Too many times we're pointing people's eyes inward. We're just saturated in thinking about ourselves and our own little world and our own concerns. And like even Abraham and Sarah, they're thinking about God's promises, but they're thinking about it in terms of what if we don't get access to this? And they get desperate and they focus on self and what they can do about it, instead of the God who has promised these things. In Revelation chapter 21, John writes, I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth passed away, and there is no longer any sea. And I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, made ready as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, behold, the tabernacle of God is among men, and he will dwell among them, and they shall be his people, and God himself will be among them. And he will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and there will no longer be any death, and there will no longer be any mourning or crying or pain. The first things have passed away. This is a continuation, I'm sure you know, a picking back up of the scene in chapter 19 and verse 7, where it says, let us rejoice and be glad and give glory to him. For the marriage of the Lamb has come, and his bride has made herself ready. And it was given to her to clothe herself in fine linen, bright and clean. For the fine linen is the righteous acts of the saints. And he said to me, write, blessed are those who are invited to the marriage supper of the Lamb. And he said to me, these are the true words of God. You get the interruption. We turn and we see the bridegroom. He is arrayed, as Marshall referenced last night, as that victorious warrior mounted on his horse, dipped in the blood of his enemies. Bob said this morning, isn't it great to sing about our victorious king's slaughter glorious? It is. So we see that picture of this glorious bridegroom. And the pause is that he finally defeats the last of his enemies. And then we can come back in chapter 21. Now we're back to the marriage. Now we're back to that feast that we introduced a couple of chapters ago. Here is a picture. Sometimes we look at that passage Gail was talking about in Matthew 22 and we think there is no marriage or giving in marriage in the resurrection. That's right, among men. But it is not true in the sense that there is no such thing as marriage in the resurrection. It's that there is only one marriage. And so at the end of all things, people say, what's the point of all this? Where are we headed with all of this? The world is going to end. And when it ends, it will not end with a bang. It will not end with a whimper. It will end with wedding bells. And I want people to see that picture and bid them live up to that glory. And I think that will do a lot more for marriages than telling them how to get in touch with their feelings. Don't you? We need to give people glory to aspire to and not just little tidbits and tips about how to help around the house or send your wife flowers. Nothing wrong with those things. I don't think that lives quite up to the glory, though, that we're talking about. We're thinking too small when we're trying to help people with their marriages. Think bigger. Think older. That's one thing we'll be getting into. People say, I want to get back to the traditional home. Oh, me too. Like 2,000 years ago and more. I'm not looking to try to reestablish 1950s America. It's like that's the most ideal picture we can give people. I'd rather have that than what we got now. Yeah. But I want to go back before that. In fact, I think that picture of the 1950s leads us to where we are right now. So we got to get back further than that. That's not the solution. I hope that that's piqued your interest. We'll talk more about these things and how we got to where we are tomorrow.